Hello, Boneside friends. This is Evan Pardue of Underhill Boneside, and welcome to episode 82 of Little Things for Boneside People. It is the year of the wood dragon. It is the year of 2024, and I don't know why I said it in that order in that way this time, but I did. But this time I'm speaking with John. I'm sorry, I never got your last name, man.
It's Kim, John Kim.
John Kim, the owner and director of Joshua Roth Tools, high quality boneside tools. How's it going, John?
I am very good. Thanks, Evan.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, we're going to be talking about Joshua Roth Tools and high quality boneside tools and accessories, and how John came to own the company and what he does for the boneside communities and all the stuff that, you know, all the awesome things that I've witnessed thus far, both working with and being a distributor of these awesome tools as well. But before I get into that, I do need to mention that our podcast is sponsored by our amazing patrons, that you can go over to patreon.com/littlethingsforbonesidepeople, and you can hang out in the Discord with these amazing people and talk about bonsai all day and share your cutting challenge pictures and ask just general questions about bonsai and horticultural things. Just shoot the shit with us, hang out with us. And me and Carmen and Mike take questions straight from the Discord as well. So if you want to do the little at sign at us and shoot us a question, that'd be really awesome. So we talk about our featured best buds. So I'm going to go ahead and say them now. Our featured best bud is going to be Shell, our Chantel Wynn. So thanks, Shell, for sponsoring the show. She's a good friend of mine, so I'd like to shout her out. And then we have a couple of new best buds. We have Andrew Willoughby. I'm sorry. Y'all know I'm awesome with names. But at least our other new best bud, and I'm not sure if I caught this one, so I'm going to say it. Kyle Ford. I think I might have shouted this one out already, but I'm just making sure. I don't want anybody to feel like they're left out. So let me go ahead and say that one too. And then, of course, our main sponsor, Joshua Roth Tools. John, thank you. And then I can't go much further without mentioning our editor, Matt O'Donnell. Makes it sound smart, cleans up our audio, and makes us enjoyable to listen to. You go over to mattodonnell.com to contact him to work on your own podcast show and audio engineering project. He's a set bassist living in Nashville, Tennessee. He's an all-around awesome guy. I say it every single time. It is in the script. Check out Matt O'Donnell Wants to Know as well. That's a great podcast show. He just broke past his 10th episode. So. So yeah, John, how's it going in California?
It's good, man. The weather is finally warming up. I say finally because El Nino's made quite the winter this past winter. So we've had a long, wet, cold winter. We're still kind of in the below average temperatures, but I don't know. It was probably about 80, 85 degrees today. So nice and comfortable.
Yeah. Humidity's not too bad where you're at.
No, it's usually single digits, but it's been a little bit higher. I don't know what it's at. Probably around 20-30% is what I'm guessing what it was today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We normally talk about the weather quite often on our show, but it is a thing. But it's also to just kind of talk to people about their zone and how the weather is and what they're, you know, because the seasons are weird. They're unpredictable. But yeah, in Louisiana, it was like 100% humidity, and then all of a sudden we got all this like cold front came through, and it is very pleasant outside, even though it's 80, and it's very unusual for this time of year. This is usually hot summer rain time, is right at the beginning. So I haven't really had to water my trees too much this week. I'm very thankful. We're planning our baby shower. It's going to be the time of this recording when we're doing this. It's going to be the Sunday, so it'll be the Sunday before this recording drops. So that's exciting. And, you know, you know how that stuff is with all the setup and the prep and then hanging out with loved ones and stuff. But yeah. So John, so let's go back a little ways to Joshua Roth. Why did this come up, and who was the former, because I've heard, like I told you this past, I heard an interview with the former owner and operator of Joshua Roth Tools. So to give me some back history on why for you.
Ooh. So I'll try to keep this short because we can go on for hours on how this came about. But
well,
Basically, a couple of years ago, we were still dealing with some of the COVID restrictions, et cetera. Let me back up a little bit further than that. So I do have a day job. I'm a project manager for a commercial construction company, and my office is roughly 45 miles away from home. And with California Orange County traffic both ways, I spend a lot of time in the car. And in the car, I listen to a lot of podcasts, yours included. So during COVID, we were working from home. I wasn't driving as much, so I kind of fell behind a few months on podcasts. And once we started going back into the office, I started catching up again. And one day, a couple of years ago, I was driving into work and I happened to listen to an Asymmetry podcast where a gentleman was being interviewed with Ryan and talking about Joshua Roth tools. And during that time, I always envisioned Joshua Roth to be this large corporation with, a dozen or more employees and this big operation because the brand was so big, so well known and prestigious. And so that was just my own thought. And I listened to Ken, the previous owner, talking to Ryan, and it turned out it was a much smaller company. And I'm sure this is the same podcast or interview you were referring to. But he kind of slipped in there that he's interested in retiring if the right person came along to take over the company. And so I got to my office and I sent an email out to, I went on the website and I found the email address and I just sent an email and said, "Hey, I just heard your interview with Ryan and that you might be interested in passing along Joshua Roth. I'm young, I've got no money, but I'm interested if you're willing to talk." I'm very, very interested and I'm serious. So he emailed me back right away and he wasn't afraid to engage with me. And, from there it was off to the races. I was in the middle of acquiring a loan to make the acquisition, and this little war happened in Ukraine and put a stop to that. And I had to start the whole process over again a few months later. And so the process took about a year and a half before we closed on the loan. And so at the very end of 2022, my wife and I became the owners of Joshua Roth Limited. And so, that was roughly a year and a half ago. In January of 2023, we relocated the business. It was previously up in Oregon, and we moved it to Southern California where we live. So since about mid-January, Joshua Roth has been back in California. The company originated in California, and then it kind of exchanged hands a few times, eventually settled up in the Oregon area where it's been for the last 30 years or so. And we brought it back down to California.
So, when's the official founding of Joshua Roth then?
Ooh, I don't have the date off the top of my head, but it's roughly 40 something years, like 42, 43 years ago.
40 something. And yeah, in that episode, I wish I could remember the number and how long ago that was. I did hear that same Asymmetry podcast episode, and I'm sure if I mean people could probably either tag it or something later on. Maybe I'd make a whenever we do this this podcast release, maybe I can try to find it and put it in the comments somewhere on Instagram or something, because it would be interesting to go in and listen to this guy Ken, who had formerly had it, and talk about the process that he was going through with it. And then this is the next stage. It's the next generation. This is
Right.
it's actually really exciting, because 40 years for an American run tool brand that that cares about carrying quality Japanese and other imported, goods and supplies for bonsai. I mean, that's not very common, isn't it?
Right. And it started off with kind of humble but right intentions, where, the gentleman that started it, Joshua Roth, he was basically bringing in some tools from Japan and making them available in the United States, because prior to that, it was kind of unobtainable. 40 plus years ago, people weren't traveling all around the world for vacations, and let alone Japan, not long after World War II, et cetera. And so he was making the quality tools available here in the United States. Ken, the previous owner, had the company for roughly 25 years, for almost 25 years. And And he's the one that really put it on the pedestal that it's on now. You know, he took it from kind of a smaller medium operation and made it a national brand, international brand, because he set up dealers in other countries as well, Australia, Puerto Rico, Mexico, Canada, you know, several other countries. And so he made it the brand that it is. And Ken's background wasn't in bonsai. He actually he's never owned a tree.
Yeah.
The secret is out. His background, his family business was tools. He grew up, his parents owned hardware stores, and he and his brother have owned and operated hardware stores. And through various circumstances, he had to close his Ace Hardware store in Oregon and was looking for another store or business in the hardware industry to purchase and run. And that's how he ran into the Joshua Roth opportunity 25 years ago. And so with his background and knowledge on tools, he really elevated the company. You know, he's the one that put a lot of the quality control practices in place. He went and found Japanese craftsmen and vendors and factories that were producing the level of tools that he was interested in selling through Joshua Roth, and also expanding the line so that there were multiple tiers or price points that would fit the budgets of different level enthusiasts, you know. Man. So, and then in addition to all that, about 10 years ago or so, he hooked up with Ryuga. And so he's been the exclusive North American distributor for the Ryuga line of products that come out of Japan. And that's through Robert Stevens. And he's a bonsai professional out of the Taiwan area, China. And, you know, he's got a plethora of tools that he has designed and he sells. And in North America, Joshua Roth is the importer and distributor for that line.
Yeah. And that was Robert Stevens' line was Ryuga, or am I?
It is Ryuga.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's who is behind the brand. And whenever I order Ryuga, actually today we got a shipment of Ryuga product. My contact is directly through Robert Stevens.
Cool. Yeah, I actually was gifted a pair of those really fancy, like, custom bonsai shears that he made one time.
Ah, the ones in the bamboo case.
Yep, his signature, special shear.
Yeah.
I actually used them to the point where they got dull, and then I dropped them on concrete and shipped the tips off of them. I was just like, okay, really, really rough on my tools. But I ended up meeting a guy who also does forging and blacksmithing. So he knew how to sharpen and basically put the tips back on, run it on a stone and put the tips back on the tool. It's a beautiful tool. And is there any other customs that he does? Cause that, I think that might be his only one, huh?
They're all his designs. So he's the one that came up with all the designs, but that RS shear, the Robert Stevens shear that you're referring to, is one that he's particularly proud of. So every single one comes in a nice little bamboo case with a warranty card, and a warranty extend. That one's got a better warranty than all the other products, but that particular shear is intended to be very comfortable and ergonomic. And the feedback that I've gotten from folks that use that is they agree that it is the most comfortable shear. It's not the lightest in weight, in particular, there's a person who does Christmas tree pruning ahead of the holidays. And so she prunes literally thousands of Christmas trees to get them ready for the holidays. And that's her shear of choice because they're comfortable and they're effective.
Yeah, it is. It has a good feel in the hand for sure. The way that he designed the, where your actual fingers are kind of feels like they're built into the curve of that, the way it's built right there. And also they have you would know what this is called, but it's when the shears are not curved with the blade, it's more curved rounded. Like if you're holding it sideways, you can see a curve in the blade.
Right, right.
I've
been told that it's also ambidextrous, so it's friendly to lefties as well.
Yeah,
I'm not a lefty, so.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, so it works for me. But I was always confused to why that curve was in the tool itself. I don't know.
Are you talking in the handle area?
Well, the whole tool itself, because sometimes shears have a curve to them.
Right.
I don't know why.
It's for more power. You get a little bit more strength and rigidity in your cuts when it's
Okay.
like that. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I've always been curious about that. And I guess this is the conversation I have if I'm curious about any tools or anything. We did do a tool and safety type episode a while back. Me and Carmen talked about what tools to keep in our tool bag and tool safety and telling people, like, you know, if you're going to use this tool, you need to either wear safety glasses if you're using power tools, obviously, but for hand tools and stuff like that, it's just like keeping your hands clear, and that's probably the best bet you can have. I've nicked and cut the ends of my fingertips several times. I mean, like, especially it almost seems like anytime that I get a brand new tool, it's like to christen the tool. I almost always cut myself with the tool. It's just the way it seems like it is,
Yeah, you
you
got to
know.
mark it with a little blood.
Yeah, it's gotta truly be part of me. So I cut straight into, it's usually the pointer or the middle finger of my right hand, because it's like the fingers that I guide the branches that I'm cutting with through. But yeah, it's an annoyance. But I mean, it's scary because, I mean, those tools are quite sharp, especially when we're starting to talk about the higher end tools. And I know that there's different categories of what you guys will carry and distribute. So there's the Ryuga is supposed to be the economy brand, right? So am I saying that right?
That's generally correct. Yeah. So because it's coming out of China, the steel is not Japanese steel, and obviously it's not Japanese craftsmanship. The QC behind it is fantastic, and they make a great product. But yeah, it's intended to be a high quality product at a lower price point. So, you know,
Okay.
the equivalent carbon or stainless steel products from Japan would cost twice as much as what the Chinese branded products are. And they're similar in quality. I'm not going to say that they're the same because the steel is obviously not the same, but it's intended to be comparable at a lower price point.
Yeah. So even those tools could be considered mid to high mid.
Yeah,
Yep.
yeah,
That's pretty
exactly.
good.
Because there's obviously other brands coming out of China or even no name branded products that are, you know, you can buy $20 shears. But tools, at the end of the day, you really get what you pay for. And so there's a reason why it costs a few more bucks.
And it goes up from Ryuga, but then like Joshua Roth even has its own entry level as
Right.
well, beginner
So
level.
the cheapest or the lowest tier products out of Joshua Roth, our packaging is color coded. So the blue packaging is the novice line. And, you know, that's kind of that entry level. It's still Japanese steel, but the manufacturing process is more of a mass production type of situation. And so they're going to be priced a little bit lower. And, you know, they're not going to be hand forged or anything like that. And then up from there, we have our white packaging tools, and that's the intermediate line. And that's kind of the bread and butter for most practitioners, right? So we're talking shears, and these are all carbon, high carbon steel shears. They're going to run somewhere about the $100, you know, plus or minus 20 bucks, depending on the size of the tool and the type of tool. And that's going to be what most hobbyists are using. The next level up from there is the orange packaging, called the professional line. And those are for the guys who are working on trees every day, you know, who maybe have over 50 trees in their collection, and they want some of the nicer things, right? So the tools are going to feel a little bit better. Like the rivet or the hardware is going to be of a little bit better quality, things like that. And then our highest tier and highest price point is the master grade, which is a stainless steel, a hardened stainless steel line of products.
Okay. And as you said, hand forged, just so I know that in Japan there are certain tools that are completely forged piece by piece, right? Are
Right.
you familiar with that?
Yeah,
So
yeah.
is it there's stuff like that in y'all's line as well?
Correct. The professional line, most of those shears are hand forged.
Awesome. That's good to know. That's good to know. Because I mean, there are like those, I don't know if it's novelty for some, but there are like those tool makers that only produce a handful of tools.
Right.
like ever, like in a week, they'll produce like maybe one shear a week, or even if they do reproduce that many tools. But I think I've seen a video, like in a YouTube video, about some guy that was doing that in Japan.
Well, those are usually thousands of dollars
exactly
for a pair. And that's for the, you know, the masters out there.
For the, the next level of, so it just keeps going until you're like God tier.
Exactly.
I don't know. I think that next part is just owning a piece of basically, because they're art at this point, because I mean, there isn't really another tool like a shear or a scissor that looks like a bonsai shear, to be honest. And it's kind of a timeless design. I mean, there's a couple of different ways to make it, but it's generally long, nice, sharp tips, one beveled edge on each blade, and usually, you know, and you can correct me if I'm missing something on this, but it's usually in the kiri, which is that straight, the straight handle, and then there's a butterfly as well, which
with the big handles.
Yep. So, but other than that, it's kind of the same tool, just in different shapes and, you know, blade lengths and chunkiness to it. It's a very timeless design. It works. And it's the only thing I can imagine trimming my trees with, other than, you know, branch cutters and stuff like that, of course. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah. With all that kind of just stated about the tools, I mean, now we're here, you know, Joshua Roth 2024, how are things? I mean, you've been owning the company for how long now? Like, has it been like a year or so?
A year and a half.
Yep. Okay. And how's it been? It's been working out? You feeling good about it?
Yeah. I mean, we knew the first year was going to be a little bit rough. So not only did we have to move the physical business and the inventory, but part of that transition included a complete change in the software that runs the business, you know, the inventory and the accounting and all of that sort of stuff. Fortunately, the previous owner was running a software system that was no longer being supported, but he was kind of grandfathered in and he kind of just kept using it. When we took over the business, that software company forced us to retire that other software. And so we moved the business in January, and then in February, we had to completely shift into a brand new foreign software that runs the business in the back end. And so there was another learning curve with all of that. You know, and then we hit the busy season of 2023. So orders were flying in and things were flying out, and we were still trying to figure out the ordering timelines with our suppliers. And so it was just a whole lot of chaos happening last year. And so things have settled down a little bit. We've hit our groove. We've kind of gotten familiar. We've gotten more comfortable with the layout here at the warehouse in California, the ordering process with our suppliers. But, you know, I think owning this business is very much like owning a classic car or a boat. There's always something that needs to be worked on. And so right when we feel like, all right, good, our to-do list is pretty good, something from left field pops up and throws us a curveball and things like that. So it's been fun. It's been exciting. You know, one of the things that I've enjoyed more than anything has been the opportunity to travel, you know, with the business as an excuse to go check out things like the national show. And we went to the first PBE, you know, a year and a half ago.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, recently I got to hang out with you over at Bonsai Central. So those are all events that are kind of out of reach as just a hobbyist. You know, I can't leave work for a week and go out to New York to go look at trees, but this business has afforded me the excuse to do that. And that's been super, super enjoyable, and getting to meet all the other professionals and folks like yourself. You know, I consider you guys, the podcasters, YouTubers, celebrities, because I'm literally listening to you guys every day in the car. I'm watching you guys every day on my TV on YouTube. You know, and to finally get to shake your hand and meet you in person is a real treat for me personally. So I've really, really enjoyed that.
Yeah. Well, appreciate meeting you as well. Yeah, we only talked over the phone, setting up the account with Underhill and kind of dealing with like hashing out how that could work. And yeah, we were supposed to have you down for, say, Bonsai. And you still, even though you couldn't make it, you still sponsored the event for our prizes and stuff. And I mean, Joshua Roth Tools has always been very generous with the way that they support, the way you guys now support the different conventions and all the things that happen as far as, you know, the new talent award contest that was at the BCI show that I went to and that I did in Houston. And then also at Bonsai Central. I mean, so yeah, I could see that. And I mean, would we love to travel to go see Bonsai for our career? And I'm doing it. And now you're getting to do it. Like, yeah, it's actually for our listeners out there. Yes, it is. It is the dream. It is awesome to say, oh, I'm just getting on the, well, for me, I drive most of the time. It's like, I'm getting on the plane to go hang out and be amongst Bonsai people and Bonsai trees. And I'm one of the contributors to that. And it is a really awesome feeling to know that there's so many people to meet, like you said. It's a small world, but it's a big world at the same time for Bonsai, especially in North American Bonsai. So yeah, we're all bound to run into each other eventually too, which is really interesting. So like you said, whenever you met me at Bonsai Central, there was several other people had walked up to me and said, hey, I know your voice, but I've never seen you in person. How you doing? I wanted to shake your hand. And that's really cool, you know. And I don't consider myself anything like that. I'm way too humble to accept the title of celebrity. That's just weird to me. But at the same time, I really do love the outreach and the opportunity to, I mean, I'm also a very sociable person. So talking to people is like one of my favorite things to do, especially when we're all together doing what we want to do, you know? So, but I know I've talked to you, John, about a couple of different things as far as Bonsai is not just your only thing. You told me you're involved with several other clubs. I feel like I haven't even scratched the surface of your interest. So obviously you're into Bonsai, right? So you have a number of, how many Bonsai trees do you have in your collection as far as that? Or what are you playing around with?
Yeah, I've only got, to be honest, I don't have any that are show worthy yet. What happened was actually, it was kind of related to this business acquisition. We were traveling back and forth to Oregon to meet with Ken, to talk about the business. You know, we first flew out there for just a weekend so we can meet face to face before we really talked business. So we made that effort, met Ken, and then came back. And then, you know, he approved of us, my wife and I. And so we started talking numbers. We went up there for kind of a shadowing session. We spent a week with him, shadowing him in the business to make sure that was something that we would be able to do. And so I was traveling a lot. I'm just bringing that up to say I was traveling a lot. And unfortunately, my tree suffered during that process. It was roughly a 6-month process where I was traveling quite a bit in order to make the business acquisition final. And during that time, all of my better trees that were in Bonsai pots or in shallow training containers of various sorts, they all died.
Yeah.
And so what I was left with was the stuff that was still in training, pre-Bonsai, that sort of stuff. That were in deeper pots, nursery pots, or kind of tucked away in the corner because it was recovering from something. So those all made it through. And those are the trees that I'm working with now. And last year, I started repotting some of those into ceramic containers and such. So my trees are kind of getting better, but I don't have anything at this moment that's worth showing. And I won't for at least a couple years. Yeah. But in total, you know, I've got maybe 20 or so.
Yeah.
Things that are not a stick in a pot. You know, I've probably got another dozen, 15 things that are just little stick in a pot sort of thing, you know, saplings or fresh cuttings, that sort of thing. So I don't have a huge collection. And like you were alluding to, I have a lot of interests. And so the trees just make up a small percentage of where my time goes.
This podcast is supported by Bonsai Bar, the beginner bonsai workshop popping up in breweries all across the Northeast. Bonsai Bar is 2 hours of tiny tree goodness disguised as a night out with friends. Come grab drinks, create a new tree, and watch as your friends and family get the bug for bonsai. Bonsai Bar is always looking for teachers and assistants, and you listen to this podcast, so you're probably already qualified. Bring your knowledge out to the bar. Apply today. Find event tickets, contact info, and more at bonsaibar.com.
Hey everyone, this is John Eads, founder of Left Coast Bonsai and proud supporter of the Little Things for Bonsai People podcast. I'm breaking into your feed today to let you know about a few exciting things we're doing here at Left Coast Bonsai. We're a small, family-owned bonsai nursery that's focused on producing high-quality bonsai plant material, as well as sourcing hard-to-find supplies for growing in your own yard. For many of us, winter is a time to pause and reflect on the year ahead. Now's a good time to decide what seedlings and supplies you need for the upcoming season. We have a large selection of seedlings that will begin shipping out mid-February for our spring season. You can also order baskets, felt bags, or aluminum wire. In addition to the seedlings and supplies, I also teach classes and study groups on a broad range of subjects, including growing trees from scratch. I hope to hear from you soon and would love to talk about how we can support your bonsai growing journey. You can find us online at leftcoastbonsai.com, on Instagram at leftcoastbonsai, or send me an email at talk@leftcoastbonsai.com. Cheers.
So I know that you had acquired a bald cypress from me not too long ago, and it was also to be in part with a carnivorous plant show that you're a part of. So
correct.
I also am into our partials. I might be using the word wrong, but I am involved with carnivorous plants to some degree, I guess you can say, because at the BCI show in Houston, my Kusumono that was made of Sarracenia and Venus flytrap. I wish I could remember the Venus flytrap. The
Dionaea muscipula.
Yeah, there you go. That's what it is. It was on the tip of my tongue. But no, it had that, and it actually had sundews, Dorsia sundews in it at one point. They were like Hercules sundews.
Yeah.
And then the sundews just didn't like it. They didn't like the setup that I had. And then also a fern. It's I'm talking like it's past tense. It's still alive. But that Kusumono that I built with those carnivorous plants actually ended up winning best Kusumono.
And everybody I saw that. Congratulations.
Blown away by it. Thank you. But not the point. I don't like to keep bringing. But no, it's the Kusumono is really interesting, and I get that. But I remember going to Nationals last year when I went, and there was Kusumono with pitchers, like especially like the parrots, and also not necessarily the parrots, but the toad. I forget what those are called. Like they're short, fat pitchers that kind of just sit on the ground.
The scientific name is Cetacenia, or lobster trap pitchers.
Yeah. And those are really cool. They come in a lot of vibrant, interesting colors with lots of hairy edges on them. And they can be purple and red and yellow and, of course, green. And they're just so cool. But I remember looking at mine and being like, this one's neat. It's interesting. But I did see a lot of carnivorous plant being used in bonsai before. And I tell people this all the time. I think Sarracenia are ground pitchers that basically look like blades of grass with the odd opening at the top. They make a beautiful pairing with bald cypresses. So I can imagine you wanted to acquire a cypress tree from me for the purpose to kind of show them, because they do very much complement habitat. There are quite literally bogs where there are stands of pitcher plants over here where they you can still actually find them in places that are undisturbed. So are you part of the carnivorous plant club? In what way? I'm just wondering.
Yeah, so I started an interest in carnivorous plants maybe 10 years ago or so. And there was a... Yeah, so I started looking up local resources, and I found that the LA area had a club. And so I started attending meetings there. I was living a little bit south of there in Orange County, and I had some friends here in Orange County that were into carnivorous plants, but they said the LA club was too far to attend their meetings. And so that, coupled with a few other reasons, a handful of folks and myself, we started a carnivorous plant club in Orange County. Awesome. In California. So, yeah, so that club, I'm the founding member and also was and am still the president. And so I'm heavily involved with that just because I run that club. It's one of the clubs that I run. And so our show is Father's Day weekend every year. So it's actually coming up in a couple weeks.
Awesome. Man.
And it's what I've been told is it's the biggest show in the United States. I don't have a way to verify that, but some of the folks that have been in the hobby much longer than I have and that have visited shows in other parts of the country have confirmed or told me that, you know, my show is the biggest one. So maybe we'll verify that at some point. But yeah, we typically have a judge show area for various plants from all over the world, carnivorous plants. And we typically have about 100 entries for that. Wow. And then we have a large sales area. So it's fun. And the Bald Cypress, I had wanted to include, we have an art category, and the art category in our show also includes mixed plantings. Mm-hmm. And so I had wanted to use, you know, it's kind of a juxtaposition where in Bonsai, the tree is the focal point and the Shirakusa or Kusamoto is the accent planting that accompanies the tree. But I wanted to do it a little bit backwards where my carnivorous planting, though smaller than the tree, is the point of the display. And then the large Bald Cypress next to it is more of a companion piece.
Yeah. And I do appreciate you bringing up the word Shirakusa, which is the actual description of whenever you're using accent planting.
Right.
Which is something I say it a lot. I know we're supposed to be over here educating on this show, and I fail to say it, but Shirakusa is also a very interesting Japanese word because it includes something that sounds like it's a naughty word, but you know, it's just the way that it's pronounced. But that does mean in accompaniment to, basically, is what that means. So it's it is interesting to know that this type of carnivorous show exists, and you're running it. And so is it on par with is it like a state convention, or is it like nationals where you set up a whole drapery and tables and stuff, or
So I think eventually that's where I want it to be, but currently so there in Southern California, I'll include Northern California. So there's within California, there's a Bay Area Carnivorous Plant Society, and they've been doing shows for about 20 years. And it's just a club level show. So their show is a 1-day event. It's about 5 hours long. So it's very compressed. It's a short show. There's a club in Sacramento that has a 1-day show. It might be a 2-day show. And then our show in Orange County. And then in August, the San Diego club does a show. So these are more club shows, but they are a little bit more, you know, if it were a Bonsai club, it'd be considered a regional show. But it's not to the national level yet because there is currently no national level carnivorous plant society or a club. There is an international carnivorous plant society that actually did start with folks in California. And I believe the 501c status, it's a California corporation. And so anyway, but that's an international level show, and they just had their international show in Vienna, Austria last weekend.
Oh, wow.
And that's a big event because people come from all over the world to attend that. But I'm hoping eventually I can host one of those, an international level show here in Southern California.
Wouldn't that be
awesome? Yeah, the Bay Area folks did it about 10 years ago up in the Bay Area, but it hasn't been in the United States since then.
Interesting. So it's like how... And a lot of people don't know this, but also like the BCI, the Bonsai International Clubs International, they do that, the same ordeal for Bonsai.
Exactly.
And they brought over the president of the BCI to Houston. And that was like the first time I realized it. I was like, oh, this is,
yeah,
this is big.
Well, he's the new president.
Yeah.
Right, right. And I've heard that he's pretty well off financially, so he can afford to travel and such. I don't know if all the presidents of BCI are capable of doing that, but yeah, I'm sure the position comes with some perks. Yeah. And that is one organization that Joshua Roth supports as well. They have a magazine, a well-known international magazine. We do advertising there.
Yep. And it's kind of crazy to see this, because Bonesai, even like, we'll go back to the carnivorous. The carnivorous thing is very interesting to me. Trust me. Like, I try to break into carnivorous stuff, but if you're part of this club and you've been running the club and it's 10 years of experience running shows, you got to know something. But we'll get back to that in a second. But as far as carnivorous care goes, wouldn't you know that, like, we're going to talk about Joshua Roth tools and stuff like that, but then we're going to double down and do carnivorous plants on.
Oh, it's easy to get sidetracked with me. That's my fault.
No. That's kind of the formula of the show, is there is no formula. So, but yeah, like with Bonesai, it's so crazy to think, like, the way that I've experienced Bonesai is I go to the New Orleans club or to the Baton Rouge club, which is the 45 minutes either direction from where I'm located. And when you go to those clubs, it just feels like it's very small town, even though, like, we're in respected, like, the biggest cities in Louisiana. There's 20, 30 people in these clubs, and it depends on how active it is that night, depending on what lecture or demo, or if they have a guest artist coming in. But whenever you do something on the scale where you see, like, Bonesai Clubs International comes in, and this president flew in and he had, like, his people with him, like, it looked like it was probably, like, he had an interpreter with him, and I think it maybe was, like, his daughter and his wife and a handful of other people, you know, and he worked on a tree, which I was like, that's awesome. So he worked on a cedar elm, which is like, that's my home team. That's like, you know, it's like he jumped on and, like, played the Saints with the Cowboys or something, you know. It was pretty gnarly. I was like, this is cool. And so, like, that's all good and stuff there. But they also handed out their own special BCI award in person. And when they handed out those awards, like, that crowd was hyped, because they were like these golden, like these circle medallion things that came in, like, these velvet, inlaid velvet casing. Yeah. I was like, holy crap, this is big. Like, and so it's just really interesting to know that you step into a Bonesai club, and if your club is part of an international thing, and then you guys are part of the International Carnivorous Society as well, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's crazy to think that this type of thing could happen. You know, like, this type of thing where a bunch of people could travel from not just outside of your town, but, like, outside of your country, and you could have something, and you could see how it's all different. And that is really cool to know that that there's a connection there. But for the Carnivorous Society, I had no idea. I know there's like Ikebana flower arrangements and garden clubs and stuff like that. And I know there's even Suiseki viewing stone clubs. Those are way smaller, unfortunately. I wish there was more of that. And there's so many different types of clubs out there. But Carnivorous, I should have put two and two together, because there's herpetology clubs. And there's oddity, others. You're probably into herps too. Yeah. So that's kind of like, I make a joke with people about with Bonesai. It's like, Bonesai people come down the pipeline as different interest people. Usually Bonesai people get into Bonesai because it connects loosely with something else they're into, that, and it takes a special type of person for their brain to work a certain way for Bonesai to make sense. You're like, oh, okay, it's not just an ornament that I put on my table. So usually Bonesai people come from saltwater aquarium people. Are you into saltwater aquariums? You are?
So just to let you know how my aquarium background looks.
Oh, God.
So when I was in college, I caught wind of the aquarium hobby. My dad had aquariums when I was a kid, Yeah. And then, you know, there's probably a 10 plus year hiatus where no aquariums were in my life. And then I was in college. And to make a long story short, within a 6 month period, I went from zero aquariums to 17 in my one bedroom apartment on the third floor.
Yeah,
when I was in college, seven of them were saltwater aquariums and 10 were freshwater.
Yeah.
And so, I've got a little bit of experience with aquariums as well.
Yeah. And I joke with people about that because, like, saltwater aquariums are so particular. If you can operate a saltwater aquarium, you can definitely grow a bonsai tree because there's so many things there, like micro environment and, you know, water quality issues that you have to fix like on the spot or you lose your entire stock. That's really finicky. And then, so it's saltwater aquariums, orchids. You're not into orchids, are you?
I am a board member of my local orchid community. I run their website. I'm their webmaster.
Okay.
So I also run their Zooms for their monthly meetings.
So we're checking boxes off.
I'm a member of three or four orchid societies, but I'm heavily involved with the one in Long Beach.
Cool. So saltwater aquariums, orchids, carnivorous plants are interesting. Usually carnivorous plants stems off of bonsai because the plant thing, and then you're like, oh, that's odd, because bonsai is interesting, but it's not exotic enough feeling for some people when it comes to that. So carnivorous plants kind of, you know, it cures that itch for some people are into it because it's gnarly, because it's like, you know, they're eating bugs and stuff, and that's cool, it's metal, you know, that's what people think. I got a friend who literally runs he's a vendor through my nursery, and he calls his company is called Living Dead Domes. So he's not only a horror movie enthusiast, but he also loves carnivorous plants, like Little Shop of Horrors style kind of stuff is kind of thing. And so it's just like a double-sided thing for him. It's really fun. I get to see a lot of really beautiful carnivorous plants, and I don't have to normally handle them as often. We sell a lot of his plants at our nursery, and then I get the opportunity to go in and create plantings or play around with them. I think ground growing pitchers are like my favorite, like just like my favorite carnivorous plant for sure, but probably also just like in my top, like not including plants that like would be used for bonsai, of course, but like that's my other favorite plant there, apart from Stokes Aster, wild daisy that grows here in Louisiana. So I think those are like my two favorite, ultimately my two favorite. And it's hard to say with the hooded pitchers. I either like, you know, pale pitchers, not very interesting, but there's also a couple of other different varieties, like the Lycophilia is really interesting, of course, because it's beautiful. The colors in them could be very, very bold, like the whites with the veins. And then of course, I don't know if a lot of people know about this, but we had a variety for a little while called Tarnock. You probably heard of this one.
Yep. It's a sterile hybrid. Yep.
And it's a cool plant, but yeah, like you said, it's a sterile hybrid, but it's one of the few ones that has a double petaled flower.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's really intriguing. It goes from that weird, because for our listeners that are not familiar with carnivorous plants, especially pitcher plants make a flower in the springtime, which once you find that out, that just changes everything, you know, because the flowers are so interesting. That's the best way I can say it, because they come up and they're like this, I compare it to it's almost alien in appearance. It looks like a little flying saucer thing, and the sides open up and the petals just like pop out the sides. They're not like elegant in the way they present themselves. They just kind of fall out the sides. It's really weird looking. And so they do have a lot of different flowers that can pop up. And the Venus flytraps, I posted the picture on my Facebook last week, since it's recording almost 2 weeks, and you can go see that. That's not a very impressive flower. It's like a five petal white, just like a regular looking white flower pops up the top of these Venus flytraps. And it's like, I wish I would have known all along that these things do this. You know, it's so interesting to know that they they both eat pollinators, but then they have their own system of shutting down that so they can kind of pull back a little bit so they can sell, so they can get pollinated. And then they go back to eating the pollinators again. It's very, very back and forth kind of thing there. And I'm sure you know which documentary I'm gonna try to refer to. There was a documentary that came out recently. Is it Nature Behaving Badly?
Ooh, I'm not familiar with that one. I've watched quite a few, but that does not ring a bell for me. While you're looking that up, I'll just throw in a little secret propagation method. So that flower you mentioned on the Venus flytraps, that actually has adventitious tissues along the stem of that flower, where if you cut that off and stick it in sphagnum moss, you will vegetatively reproduce that Venus flytrap out of that flower stalk.
I did not know that. You could take the flower out, the stem.
Yeah, just cut the stem off, you know, at any point, and then stick that cutting into some sphagnum moss, keep it humid, and in a few weeks, you'll see a little baby flytrap grow out of that cut site.
That is so odd.
And you can mass produce Venus flytraps that way, clone them. It's a vegetative reproduction, so it's cloning.
That is so weird.
Yeah.
Because I did notice in the past that that if you look really close at some of the fly traps when they produce the flowers, there's little tiny fly traps.
Yep. Sometimes it'll just do that at the top where it flowers on the stalk. Mm-hmm. If it's humid enough, it'll just start, you know, kind of like what the orchids do with a cakey, where it's a basal growth on the flower stalk.
Yep.
It'll do that on Venus flytraps as well.
That's so crazy to me. This is why we're talking about it. It's like the more you know about it, it makes it that much more interesting. Because with the pitchers, the only way to reproduce those is to either get them to germinate, which is a, you know, not the easiest thing in the world. They're actually one of the more difficult plants to get them to reproduce via flowering and then, you know, pollinating and getting a viable seed. And then you have to stratify them. And that takes up to like a year or two, right?
Right. But the good news with the Sarracenia is they grow on rhizomes, and the rhizomes are very easy to divide.
Yep.
And, you know, if the plant's happy, it's going to triple in size every year. So it's exponential growth. And so you can break off pieces of that whenever you repot that chunk of the rhizome, and that'll be off and running as its own plant. So they're pretty easy to divide. Yeah, especially when they're dormant.
And so this is one thing that comes up a lot. I can't remember the last person that asked me my opinion on type of soil. And the owner of the nursery of Underhill, Doug, he is a Sarracenia enthusiast. He has a bunch of actual rare, I forget what they call that. It's whenever there's a site where there is a cross.
Yeah, the location data.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So that picture is specific to that one spot.
Right.
And then he has plants like that. He has pitcher plants that are specific to areas that are either going to, I mean, they're so limited in their family and their source that the colony is either, I mean, it might be only a couple of square feet where they exist, or they just got eradicated. And that's really sad to know, but also it's really interesting because there's people who care a lot to keep those rare varieties going. And at one point, he made the switch over in his soil. He went from sphagnum to the coconut husk stuff.
No, no.
Exactly. And he read this on a forum from another supposed Sarracenia expert that said this was like the future of keeping your pitchers happy. I was like, that sounds weird because they've been growing in this dissolving, decaying sphagnum moss for like years now, and they've been great, you know.
Yeah.
He switched over to that. So the biggest question that I get from people is because they start out in sphagnum when we get them, and I usually do This is me. This tell me, and you can correct me if there's some missing information here, of course, because I need to be updated on it as well. Is that I'm usually doing like a peat and sphagnum, and I like to not just put the pitcher straight into it, but for that to be a little bit more broken down, you know, kind of used already, I guess you can say, so that it's already becoming it because they like decomposing crappy, low quality soil so that the other components of them can work more efficiently. Correct?
Yes. Short answer is yes. Long answer is the pitcher plants, a lot of the sundews, the fly traps, they're growing in bog areas, right? Like your neck of the woods, bog, southeastern United States. And so the soil conditions there in their native habitat is varying degrees of decomposing peat bogs or sphagnum, right? So long fiber sphagnum moss works, whether it's live or dead. Pure peat moss, which is essentially, you know, decaying or decayed long fiber sphagnum, is great as well. And, you know, when the plants are pollinated and germinated and reproduced sexually through flowers, they're going to land on the upper part of the soil wherever they go. And that's going to be usually kind of a newer part of the bog versus some of the plants that have been there in the ground for decades are going to be a more decomposed, more swampy, more mucky type scenario. So all that to say, my recommendation for soil media, for anything that's terrestrial or growing in the ground, is mainly peat moss, 100% organic peat moss, because unfortunately, if you buy bag products from big box stores, it's enriched with things, various things. And so if you get 100% organic peat moss, that's good to go. And that unfortunately comes in different qualities as well, or different grades. I always get the premium stuff that comes out of Canada. It's really good, really clean, not going to find a bunch of chunks or sticks in there. And it's going to be all very fine, fresh peat moss versus some of the cheaper stuff. You're going to find a bunch of junk in there. So anyway, all that to say that's the main component. I add in some inorganics to break it up so it doesn't become just a clump of mud. Okay. And you can do that with either the sphagnum moss or you can do, I prefer pumice because pumice won't float.
Wow.
A lot of people use perlite. But the challenge with perlite is the carnivorous plants like to be wet. And so I grow them in trays of waters. And perlite inevitably, because it's so light, works its way to the top of the soil in the pot or whatever medium, you know, you've got it potted in. And so it gets kind of annoying to see this like snow cap on the top of your pot after a few months. And then it's just impossible to get rid of. And then it sticks everywhere and the dust is really bad for you and blah, 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 blah. So
it's unsightly,
It costs a little bit more and the pots are a little bit heavier, but my preference is to use pumice and I do sift that. So, you know, I don't get all the little teeny tiny dust particles in there that can kind of harden and clump it up. So anyway, I depending on what I'm planting and the size of the plant, it's going to be the vast majority is just going to be high quality peat moss and then some sand or pumice or long fiber sphagnum to help break it up. Fun fact. For Venus fly traps, I actually plant them in 100% long fiber sphagnum moss. I don't use any peat. The roots seem to be happier in that kind of planting medium. So that was a trick I learned or a tip I learned from one of the best fly trap growers that I know of, period. Her name's Maggie. And she was one of the founders with me for the Carnivorous Plant Club here in Orange County. She unfortunately moved to Texas a couple years ago and has been very active in the Texas community. But she is well known all around the world. There are fly trap and Nepenthes growers in Europe that know who Maggie is because she's just so darn good at growing these plants. Yeah.
Just a quick reference for listeners. When you say the higher quality peat moss stuff, in case people are going to start dabbling into carnivorous stuff after this episode, what peat moss brand or what are we looking for in particular, just out of interest?
So I think it's Pro Mag is what the bag says. Let me Google that while we're talking. Fortunately for me, the distributor for that brand is here in Anaheim, which is 5 minutes from my house. And yeah, so I go to Will Call directly from them. But yeah, it's called Pro Moss. That's, as far as I know, the best quality peat moss you can buy. And, you know, it's even that brand will have different varying degrees of quality, but it's a black plastic bag. I get a whole bale, you know, it's like 3 cubic feet, and I buy 5 or 6 of those a year because I have quite a few plants.
Okay. And so if we're talking a handful of bonsai, like 20 or so, and then some other grow out plants, so carnivorous plants, I'm willing to bet you have.
I have a lot.
A lot. Probably you can't even count it, probably.
I can't count it. I lost count. Yeah.
Yeah. And so another thing too is like with the carnivorous plants, this is something I try to stress to a lot of people. They don't have to live their life in a greenhouse.
Uh-huh.
They are full sun plants most of the time, except for the one you said earlier,
Nepenthes.
Nepenthes, the hanging pitchers.
Right.
They prefer a little bit more shade. From my experience. So you keep yours outside all year. It does it get cold enough to trigger a proper dormancy for them, or is it too cold?
No, they get dormant here. So some of the largest commercial growers for Sarracenia are up in the Northwest, Oregon, yep. Washington, you know, and they're covered in snow for months out of the year, and they're perfectly happy there.
Yep. Which is crazy to me because when you see carnivorous plants down here in Louisiana, even where they're native to, you'll see them in the window as a foliage interest plant or uh-huh. in a greenhouse as like a tropical. And I'm like, for crying out loud, Louisiana is subtropical. This is where they're supposed to live. You know, the one thing that I know that gets some people with a lot of the carnivorous plants is the watering is a little challenging because city water is not going to cut it. So like stuff with chlorine or heavy minerals or anything like that usually puts a damper on them. Before we kind of wrap up the carnivorous talk here, because they don't really need much fertilizer. If everything's
working out. They don't need
any
fertilizer. Yeah, they don't need any fertilizer. That'll actually kill the plant.
Yep.
And like you were saying, water is the only tricky part, yep. but it also makes them the easiest plant. So another badge on my Girl Scout, whatever, right? So I'm also a master gardener, and I tell people carnivorous plants are literally the easiest plants you can own because you can't underwater and you can't overwater if you grow it in a little tray of water, right? So it'll wick up the water from whatever vessel you have underneath the pot. And watering is usually the biggest challenge for any plant, you know. And so I tell people it's the easiest plant you can keep. However, that comes with the big fat asterisk that the water needs to be pure water, like you were saying.
Yep.
So unless you're blessed to be up where your tap water is under 100 ppm, you know, and it's very clean water, you're going to have to either buy distilled water or reverse osmosis water. I have an RODI unit because of my aquariums, and so I make my water for my carnivorous plants. And those units aren't that expensive, and it's not that hard to do. But you know, if you've got maybe 5 or 10 plants, just buying a gallon for $1 is going to last you for months and months. So it's not hard to do. You just got to know to do it. Because if you just water straight out of the hose and your tap water, you know, mine's about 170, 200. I know parts of Arizona, it's over 1,000 ppm. So that will definitely kill your plant over time.
Yep. And one more thing about the Sarracenia. I have a Sarracenia it's a ceramic container, but the hole is very small at the bottom. So if my understanding is right, with some of the Sarracenia, especially the pale pitcher that grows here, they don't mind it to be dry sometimes, and they need oxygen through the bottom is what my experience has been with these particular pitcher plants. So if the sphagnum moss and the peat has broken down to the point where it's just mush, that will actually cause a lack of oxygen to the root system, and then the coal will be clogged at the bottom too. correct?
It can, yeah. It can
in
get
theory?
There.
Okay. Yeah. In theory, so, okay.
Yeah, and that's actually not a big problem, especially because these plants grow so quickly. You know, you're probably going to end up pulling that out and having to repot it just because of its size before the substrate degrades to the point where it becomes toxic. So my plants generally don't stay in its same pot and media for more than 2 or 3 years because it's going to outgrow that vessel no matter what.
Okay. But so in addition to that, might be overly root bound then.
It could be. Yeah. And I have some plants, if I miss a repotting, they will literally break apart. They'll create cuts and openings on the sides of plastic nursery pots and break their way out.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. So I guess if they're in a ceramic container, that's not going to happen. And then they'll just get suffocated.
It might start growing, you know, walking out of the pot, like just like some of the trees do. If you don't repot it for a long time and it starts getting taller and taller and the roots push the plant out of the pot, mm-hmm. It can definitely do that.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I'm glad that we could break into carnivorous talk here as well. But it
new
is
podcast.
Yeah, exactly. It is very interesting because it's like I said, it's another thing that we can grow alongside our bonsai as accent or of interest. And carnivorous plants do look awesome in bonsai containers. Especially when a Kusumoto container, like rounds or trays or flats or rocks. I mean, there's a lot of really flexible things that you can do with these types of plantings for sure. And
absolutely.
And like you said, it's like the easiest thing that you could care for. That Kusumoto I mentioned way earlier, I mean, it just gets watered and it sits at the nursery, and the nursery is on well water, which is like one of the cleanest aquifers down here in Louisiana.
Yeah.
And I don't do anything to it. I trim back the dead pitchers and fly traps whenever they're done. But other than that, yeah, it's just extremely straightforward. And people love it whenever they see those and there's the bugs caught them and stuff. I mean, it's just, yeah. But anyway, we covered basically the aquariums, carnivorous plants. Orchids are a little bit different. That's a whole different thing. You know, it's not, I know they also take clean water, and it's more of an air plant versus type of orchid that you're growing, and that gets super complicated. Correct. So I don't even
orchids,
know if it's worth going into on this.
Yeah, no, orchids are a whole nother beast, and there's just so many types of orchids, you know, terrestrial, epiphytic, you know, and there's big ones, small ones, and all of that kind of stuff. And you mentioned air plants. I am also a member of a local bromeliad society. Yes, air plants and bromeliads are of interest to me as well.
Yeah. So are there any other clubs that you aren't part of?
That I'm not a part of, or I am a part of?
So give me a list of the ones you're not. No, I'm just joking.
Yeah. So the other club that I'm really, really involved with is the California Turtle and Tortoise Club. Mm-hmm. Yes, there is a club for turtle nerds. I am the CEO of the overall organization. I oversee 13 chapters throughout Southern California. And I help run two of those chapters, the Long Beach chapter and the Orange County chapter. We just celebrated our 60th anniversary last month. And so that was super fun. I'm really involved. Like you were saying earlier, you mentioned herps, turtles, tortoises, obviously, but, I also have a lot of experience with lizards, various lizards, small stuff. I have a few crested geckos now, but, my past resume includes tegus and water monitors, and I bred bearded dragons when I was in high school. I've had chameleons, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. I mean, it's all adjacent. And I guess one of the things I could ask is like, because you're overseeing your day job. And then, of course, you acquisition Joshua Roth. And now you got all these. So you must have like a rhythm. You must get up and check all your plants, your aquariums, your orchids, there's got to be a rhythm to that. It seems like a lot, but I'm also a guy over here myself, I'm managing basically a specimen collection in my own backyard and go to the nursery and manage a collection there. And so there is a rhythm to it, I'm sure.
And support. So my wife doesn't have a whole lot of hobbies of her own. Like, she likes to do art, sculpting, painting, crocheting, that sort of stuff. But she's super, super supportive. So to be perfectly honest and open with everybody, my wife, Michelle, is who's behind Joshua Roth full time. So she's at the warehouse every day. She's the one responding to messages and pulling orders, letting me know if there's any issues, you know, things like that. So she's here every day, on weekends as well. And so that's number one, is having a spouse that is so supportive and helpful, and not with just Joshua Roth, but with all of my other clubs as well. Like, you know, last weekend I had one of my aquarium clubs. We had our meeting on Saturday, and she was, you know, my right hand running the meeting with me there. You know, and so, and the big show that's coming up for the carnivorous plants, you know, she's kind of the point person for everything. And so she does a lot of the heavy lifting for me, with me. And so that's super supportive. And then the other secret to living such a busy lifestyle is we don't have kids. that definitely is what affords us the time and resources to be able to do all the things we enjoy.
Yeah. Well, and there's no issues with that at all. I mean, I've met people who don't have children, and they've had a lot of really crazy things that they've gotten into, and there's a lot of time, and you don't get as many stress marks and stress lines as some other people will with children. I've noticed that. I've been surprised whenever I meet some people and they're like, "Oh yeah, I'm so and so age." And I'm like, "Really?" So yeah. Met a couple of people like that who, you know, that's cool. And I say that, and I'm like about to have
exactly
my child here, and I don't know. We'll see how it works. I'm sure it'll be fine. It'll be one more thing to nurture. But you know, that's awesome that your wife is willing to go and support you that in that way. I mean, I have a very good support system with my own wife as well, but she's not running any companies for me, but she does water the trees occasionally. But she, the support in a partner is, I mean, that's, you couldn't ask for a better thing, because I mean, there's a lot of stuff to get into, and there's always a lot of things that could be missed, especially if it's all managed by one person. I mean, I get burnt out thinking about what YouTube video I might watch for the evening pertaining to either Magic the Gathering, or I've recently got into birding recently, where I'm starting to really get serious about that, and I'm trying to absorb all this stuff, and I just get burnt out trying to just absorb the information. So having an extra person there to be like, "It's okay, I will help you continue your obsessions with you."
Right.
But yeah, no, that's really cool to know that she's doing that. And so I guess one of the things before we kind of start wrapping up here too, is that I know we haven't really mentioned a whole lot about Joshua Roth tools as far as like getting tools or like any things that are offered from Joshua Roth as far as that goes. But I feel like the brand has been around for so long that it's kind of just known, especially if people have been serious about bonsai. There's people that have been doing bonsai for much longer, like three times longer than I have, you know, 30, 40 years of experience in bonsai, and they recognize Joshua Roth as one of those brands where it's like, "Oh yeah, that's a money brand. That's where you get your really good tools from." But we haven't really talked about, but we can touch on this really quick. So just people know where to obtain the tools. And one of the places, of course, you can get it from Underhill. If you go to underhillbonsaistore.com and you go to our tool section, and of course, Joshua Roth, we have just about the entire catalog as far as I can tell. We don't have every single piece, but we have all the essentials plus a little bit extra. And then, but you are always looking for distributors as well. And that's kind of the way that Joshua Roth works. So you can break us down on that real quick, of course.
Yeah, one of the things that made the business lean and efficient was the fact that it is a purely wholesale and distribution setup. So Joshua Roth, we don't sell direct to the end user. We only sell wholesale to dealers like yourself, like Underhill. Good. And so, you know, I'm really big on supporting brick and mortar businesses. Online is great, and there's a time and a place for that, especially if you're not living in a metropolitan area and you don't have a local business, or if you're just too shy and you don't want to go to a place and you know, shop. So anyway, so we actually have an intentional emphasis on supporting local nurseries or professionals, right? So we have some folks that sell our products and they don't have a nursery that sells trees, but what they do is they go to shows and they sell at shows or at club meetings. So, you know, that's a business that we want to support. Or if there's a professional out there that's, you know, for example, if somebody's just come back from their apprenticeship and they're starting to do a lot of traveling, you know, all of the current superstars like Bjorn and Ryan, all started the same way. The model is you come back from your apprentice, you travel, you do demonstrations, you know, and you earn a little bit of money that way in order to set up your nursery. And so even for folks in that stage of their career, we want to support them by either providing them tools that they could use and or sell when they do their demonstrations. But I would encourage listeners, if your local Bonsai supplier, whether it's a garden center or a dedicated nursery, if they're not carrying Joshua Roth tools, to ask them about it, and they can reach out to me, and we're always happy to sign up new dealers. But, you know, our business model is we want those nurseries and those local resources to be healthy, a healthy ecosystem, if you will, and support them. So, of course, folks like Underhill that are a little bit more technologically advanced, you know, you've got your website and folks can order tools through you. There are several other online vendors that sell both Joshua Roth and Ryuga, but we have a very strong network throughout the country, as well as other countries that are brick and mortar and they don't have an online presence. So we're happy to sell to any shop that's a legitimate, you know, outfit. You know, we get weirdos that contact us all the time that want to do an Amazon store or sell out of the garage or something like that, but you know, we shoo those people away, and we want to support folks like Underhill that, you know, are not just there for the money, but they're there to help benefit and improve the overall community.
Yeah, that's a really great way to say it. And that's why I chose to go with Joshua Roth after kind of hearing how that is, especially over that original episode of Asymmetry, and now talking to you. And it's really awesome to know that you're still carrying that same mindset and that same business practice. And that's extremely important. And you're also an enthusiast, and your other interests are spread across. You have quite the spread, as you would say, in a charcuterie, like of different interests that contribute to that as well. So that I think you're a pretty ideal, if not the perfect guy for the job, you know. So, but unfortunately, we have to kind of wrap it up, come to a close on this episode. So, is there anything else that you wanted to add, real quick, before I kind of spout off the shout outs and bring us to the end of this week?
Well, I do want to thank you again for doing this podcast and for running Underhill, because, you know, one of the things that attracted us to Joshua Roth was the fact that there was already a spirit and mentality in the company to support the community, with an emphasis on folks that are entering the hobby, or, you know, the more novice level of hobbyists or enthusiasts, because we need that constant inflow of new blood into the hobby for us to continue, right? And so the fact that you're putting in the effort to do this podcast, as well as the other 6 or 7 Bonsai related podcasts that I listen to, you know, I really appreciate everybody putting in that effort, because I know how hard it is. I've always wanted to be a part of a podcast or something, or YouTube or something like that, that can reach the masses. I just don't have the time and capacity to do it. So I'm envious and appreciative of the folks that put in the time and effort like yourself, you know. Yeah. And so anyway, thank you for the opportunity. Thank you for doing what you're doing. And I definitely love and hope that we can continue to support all of your efforts going forward.
Yeah. Yeah. I really appreciate all the kind words, John. And I know, yeah, with you guys, like being the main show sponsor of Little Things that, you know, that it can only, you know, I can't imagine it being any better in a better situation. That's why I've told like Carmen and stuff. It's like, holy shit, we're sponsored by Joshua Roth. That thing, you know, that's back whenever I was younger, it's like, oh, that's a dream. You know, like, oh, cool. I see this main brand in a Bonsai magazine, like a Bonsai Today magazine back in the day. And like, now they sponsor the show. That's really cool. So, but yeah, appreciate, like I said, appreciate all the words, all the kind words and all the, you know.
Hey, here. Speaking of which.
Yeah, go ahead.
I want to make sure that we plug the fact that we did a little collaboration shirt together.
Yeah, yeah,
and
definitely.
That's available on the Underhill website. So if folks haven't seen that, go check out the Underhill website and look for that long sleeve shirt that Evan helped produce.
Yeah, for sure. And I know that we were talking about doing limited runs on those shirts. I know we mentioned doing limited runs on those shirts, but it's hard to keep producing shirts and making hits that are going to sell like that. So we're going to be running those shirts more often. And for now on, I think we'll be doing like convention exclusive versions of shirts instead of saying that we're going to, you know, stop a design, because the Joshua Roth shirt design is pretty awesome. Yeah, it's a black long sleeve shirt, has on the front says I'm into heavy metal, and it has a pair of knob cutters behind it where the knob cutters are kind of like smoky and atmospheric, like it almost looks like a hooded figure, like some kind of like creepy metal music kind of music video thing going on. And then down the sleeves it has one of my Bald Cypress designs on it, one sleeve, and on the other it says make the cut, which I really adore the sentiment and the thought into that wording, because usually in metal music there's a shout out, like in a breakdown or a really harsh thing that's said in metal vocals. And so it's like this thing that people need to hear, like make the cut in order to make a better tree or get ramification where you need it, or refinement, or taper a branch, you have to make those cuts. And on the back, it, of course, it has the Josh Roth and the Little Things for Bonsai People logo on the back. It's a great shirt. And I always, so this, you guys know, when we run these shirts, I have a local t-shirt printer, Unhallowed Designs. Jonathan Wagner, this is my good friend of mine. He's actually out of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And he orders the shirts. I put my hands on the shirts that he orders to make sure that they're of the quality that I want them to be. I usually either print on comfort colors or American Apparel or something of the same grade of a t-shirt, you know, like spun cotton shirts. I want the shirts to hold up. I don't want you to have to like wash them and then they get distorted whenever they come out the dryer or something. So yeah, I love those shirts. I love the t-shirt designs. And it's awesome to see, like, I went to a convention in Texas and then St. Louis and saw people wearing the shirts there. And I'm like, it blows my mind. So I think I've mentioned this multiple times, but every time it will continue to blow my mind. So, but anyway, yeah, like I was saying, thanks again, John, for everything that you've done for Joshua Roth. And of course, also for sponsoring our show. And we will have more and more conversations, I'm sure, because I'm going to see you at conventions, because I'm going to continue to do conventions, and we'll always have little, you know, meetups, and we can have recaps on the conventions. We did record some content for Bonsai Central. Unfortunately, it was lost amongst all the craziness. But I mean, there's more conventions to hang out and talk Bonsai at, of course. So, but yeah, I'm going to go ahead and do the Patreon readout real quick, and then we'll have a closing remark, and then we'll have a good rest of the week. How's that sound to you?
Sounds good.
All right. So yeah, we're starting to do our Patreon readout at the end of our episodes now, because they were getting kind of crazy and long. So if you listen this far into the episode, thank you so much for listening all the way through, and only improves the algorithm. And then you get to hear your name at the end of each episode. So we'll start a list off with Vicky Auth, Boyd Snellgrove, Ricky Rules, Joshua Bentley, Snappy Chappers, Joel Jenkins, Justin Knight, Backyard Bonsai Australia, Ben Crean, Greenwich Gardens, Taylor Peacock, Chase Pertweet, Austin Adkins, Karen Coswell, Lewis Torres, AC Castle, Bonsai Marine, J.A.S. Potts, Chris Bossoon, Timothy Arsenal, Randy Bennett, Victrina Ridgway, LaRon's Bonsai Garden, Nate Murray, Nancy Hoffman, Joshua Ross Tools, J.M. Stewart Woodworking, David N, Barry's Bonsai, Sean Seaman, Gilbert Jorez, David J. Boccaccini, Chantel Wynn, David Smith, Hist Warrior, Byron Myrick Pottery, Dale. I love just going through this list of like first and last names and different names, and we just have Dale. Eddie Fernandez, Joseph Domingue, Wesley Thompson, Kyle Forward, Angel Niblock, Andrew Willoughby. Really hope that's right. Kyle Forward. And then, of course, we have our specimen best buds, Unryuin Bonsai in Australia, Christina Quaforia, and Bill Butler of Bill's Bayou, anchoring down the end of each episode with his name. He always tells me that this is the most important thing he hears on each episode. You still got it, Bill. So, yep. And those are the people that support us and love us. Thank you guys so much. We'll catch up with you guys on the next episode. And again, thank you, John, for hanging out. So let's say goodbye to him. Y'all have a great week.
All right. Thank you, Evan.
Yes, sir.